What happens when wind turbines meet wheat fields? Across Western Australia, more and more farmers are being approached by energy companies with big ideas and big infrastructure. But what does it all mean for your farm? This limited series from Farm & Co dives into diversifying farm income, integrating renewable energy into agriculture, a project sparked by growers just like you looking for clarity, opportunity and a fair deal. Over three episodes, the series unpacks the findings of a grower survey and explores what's really driving renewable energy interest in WA's ag sector, from the financial upside and long-term business resilience to the social, legal and environmental realities on the ground. Whether you're curious, cautious or already in talk, this series is your independent guide to navigating the renewables rollout. Welcome to episode 2 of Farm & Co's three-part series on integrating renewable energy into agriculture. I'm your host, Shannon Beattie, and in our first episode, we looked at why these projects are showing up on WA farms and what's driving grower interest. Now we're shifting focus to the business end of things, the economic opportunity and the many factors that can influence profitability, from payment structures and lead times to inflation, land access and the scale of each project, no two agreements are the same. Some involve just a couple of landholders, while others span entire shires. So how do you assess the value and risks for your own operation? To help break it down, I'm joined by Farm & Co Farm Management Consultant Greg Easton and IBQ Consulting Senior Associate Fraser McMillan. Greg and Fraser, it's great to have you here. Can you start by introducing yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Greg Easton, the Farm Management Consultant at Farm & Co Farm Management Consultants, and I've got clients from down south to Albany through to Karoo. And I've been involved in this project because I've got clients that have been propositioned for wind farm opportunities. I've helped put the report together and I'm now helping with the podcast.
Fraser, over to yourself. Can you give us a little bit of an intro to who you are, what you do and what your role in the project has been?
Thanks, Shannon. Yes, I'm Fraser McMillan. I'm a civil engineer. I work for a company called IQ Consulting. We do quite a lot of work on the development and civil engineering side of renewable projects, particularly wind farms. My involvement in the project has been a sort of a high level oversight and a bit of, expert input just from experience being in around these projects for a long time.
Fraser, we'll stay with you for a moment. I understand that no two projects are ever going to be the same, and some projects will have as few as, say, two landholders, while others have large areas and a lot of landowners within a shire. Can you explain why this is and where that difference comes from?
So there's a whole heap of factors that go into what makes a successful project come together. If we look at the wind example, it's really not always the wind resource itself that's top priority. Connecting to the grid and the capacity on the local and sort of regional transmission networks is really important. And then there are a whole lot of other factors from ecological, cultural heritage, all sorts of different things that go into what areas are appropriate and how much of a certain area can be utilised for the developments. And then also there's the economic side. So the developer will either be looking at going into the market to sell the power, or they may be signing up power price agreements with a certain customer. And so what that demand is from a particular customer or what they think they can sell from that location with the investment they've got to make to build the project always ends up, when you throw all of those factors in, you can end up with a project that's two or three turbines up to projects that are many hundreds of turbines.
Greg, over to you. When it comes to these proposals from different proponents, each grower who receives one will often have a different number of turbines on their property, even compared to others within the same project. Why is that? And how is that, I guess, just how is that fair?
Well, really, it comes down, it's not fair that you own 1,000 hectares versus your neighbour owns 2,000 hectares. And the reality is it's the footprint that you own. And part of that can be, I assume, and Fraser might want to correct me, but part of that might be how far away you are from transmission lines as well. So if you're on the edge of a project, it might be only feasible to go against one edge of your property versus the other part where you across a road or whatever. So yeah, it's not fair, but farming is not fair and life's not fair. And if you have big scale and you're near to transmission lines, then you're probably a better proponent than somebody that's a long way away.
That sound about right to you, Fraser?
Yeah, it is. And again, there's lots of different factors that go into it, but some areas of properties due to the topography or just what's going on regionally might be better for the resource. How close you are to your neighbours and those sorts of things, where neighbouring households are and all those sorts of things come into it. There are different offsets that need to be observed. And again, back to what Greg said about, I suppose, proximity to existing transmission lines to be able to export the power and whatnot. So there are a whole heap of different factors that go into how many turbines can be placed in a certain area and then within a project, how those turbines are there dispersed and the offsets from each other as well is a pretty strong factor that they need to be spread out, especially as they get bigger and bigger, to make sure that they don't impact the power generation of each other.
This episode is all about the business end of things and the economic side of things when it comes to these projects. Greg, can you talk me through or introduce us to the two most common remuneration models offered to landowners in these projects?
So what we've found through the report is the two most common ones is a straight lease per tower, where you're paid an annual lease fee, essentially, for having the tower. And the other one is where you receive part of your income based on production. So for farmers, that would be equivalent of a share farming arrangement that they're familiar with. But they're the two key remunerations currently going around.
Let's start with that, I guess, flat fee model that you mentioned, that first one that you mentioned. Fraser, I understand that that's the more common model that people tend to be going with at the moment. Can you talk to us about how that actually works and what the agreement really involves?
Yeah, and it's probably worth taking a step back and looking at the typical process, and different developers do things differently. I do want to say as well that I'm very much on the engineering side of things, but through our experience, we have touch points and understand how these agreements come to pass, I suppose. But the typical process is at the very early stages, a developer will look at an area, start to firm up what they think might be achievable in that area, and then go and start talking to landowners. And what they're looking for at that early stage is an exclusivity agreement, which is an agreement that you'll work with them, and it'll give them confidence that they can continue to develop the early stages of the project, understanding that they've got you and potentially your neighbours on board with the development at those early stages. Once the development progresses and starts getting a lot more firmed up and they'll start doing studies, they might go out and put some equipment on the properties to monitor wind or sunshine or whatever the project's going to be, and they'll start doing the early stages of the planning processes, talking to the local and state governments and federal governments. If they need to do that, they might start looking at ecological and cultural heritage surveys and those sorts of things. But during that stage, once they get to a point where they understand that this project has legs, it's going to go somewhere, or at least they hope so, they might, depending on who they are, whether they're a smaller operation that will then need to go out and either get investment or look to on-sell the project, or if they're a larger company that might take it the whole way through. But they'll get to a stage where there's a lot more confidence in the project, the details are a lot clearer, and what's achievable in the project is there's a lot more confidence around, I suppose. They'll then look to move from that exclusivity agreement onto an option agreement, and that's when you're signed up. If you do sign up, you're signed up on an ongoing payment with a time frame around it, saying within the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever the agreement is, they can pull that option and say, righto, we're going to move ahead with the project. And that option agreement has payments, or has I suppose, reimbursement for the time that the option is available to them. And then that should also set out what the grounds of the full agreement for the construction and operations of the project are. So, yeah, so you start with that exclusivity, typically move on to an option, and then once they pull the trigger, then you're rolling into the agreement proper, I suppose, which then gets us back to what we were talking to around the flat-based or flat-fee annuities, I suppose, versus a profit share or production agreement that, I suppose, yeah, rises and falls on the
on the production of the equipment that's on your property.
So in that case, let's go into that flat fee model. How does those payments for that one actually work in terms of, are you getting paid per turbine, per capacity of that turbine? How does it actually work?
So the flat fee leases or annuities are typically based on a megawatt rate. So the turbines that we're dealing with at the moment are typically somewhere between sort of 5 and 7 megawatts per turbine, and the grants will be a certain price per megawatt installed per year. And so that doesn't matter if the turbine produces to its full potential or not, you'll still be paid that per megawatt rate for the number of turbines on your site every year.
And then if we look at that more profit share sort of model, Greg, what does that involve? I understand that there's potentially the opportunity for higher income, but there are some other risks involved as well.
Yeah, there is, because in essence, you're relying on the towers to turn to generate the income. And so if you're not producing, or that the power on the project next door is cheaper, then your project might not run on any given day, and therefore your income won't be as certain. So you do need to have a higher reward to take that degree of risk, because you don't know what the future might hold around that production. And if you've got a early wind cap turbines that are less efficient, and someone's got more efficient ones that can produce at a lower cost, potentially you might not wind up with your wind farm running or your towers running on your farm, and therefore your income will be curtailed.
So I guess it's one of those situations where if yours keep running, you have the potential to earn more, but if your neighbours are running more and making it, you know, for less, then yours might be the first to kind of get switched off and not used.
Yeah, that's one of the risks that I foresee while sitting on the other end of this, because we know that the first of the wind farms that were done are starting to come to the end of their first life, and some of those aren't being renewed because they can't put the new bigger towers on. So to me, that suggests that there's a degree of risk, and we know that with computer technology, it's rapidly improved, and I suspect that the turbine technology, what went in 5 years ago, is nowhere near as efficient as what's going in today. So there is a risk on the end that maybe the returns won't be as great as they were in the short term.
What are some of the other risks involved from a financial sense, Fraser, that we should be thinking about before entering into these agreements?
Oh, that's a very good question. As with anything, the landowner needs to be well aware of the impacts and opportunities that these sort of projects can have on their farming operations. Ideally, the developments are done in a way, and they're done very collaboratively, so that impact on farming operations is as minimal as possible. And when done well, I suppose the positives far outweigh the negatives as far as the small amount of land use that might be diminished, or I suppose inconveniences, particularly during construction, but then obviously ongoing for the life of the projects as well, with access to the properties and those sorts of things. But certainly those need to be weighed up and need to be understood at the early stages to make sure that the remuneration is what it needs to be to outweigh those. I suppose back to Greg's commentary around curtailment and the changing of technology, it's certainly the case that technology has changed dramatically in the last 20 to 25 years, but it's ongoing, and it has changed certainly greatly in the last 5 years. As far as curtailment or loss of income from newer projects, it's less likely, I suppose less likely from the change in technology from newer turbines and that sort of thing. It's more going to be impact on a project-to-project basis, more to do with the connection and then the energy market as a whole. So certainly curtailment of power production of certain projects is definitely a thing, but it's not going to be because there's a newer turbine being installed down the road. It's going to be more so about the access to the grid and the capacity in the grid at certain times, and whether or not those wind farms or even other power providers are competing for that capacity in the transmission. The renewables themselves are very, very low cost to produce once they're built and installed. So once you have a project up and running, it'll be typically bidding in the market at that very low cost or even zero cost. And so whether you've got a turbine that's 10 years old or a brand new turbine, they'll still be producing power at the same cost and getting paid the same. So that's less of an issue, but certainly curtailment for grid capacity is definitely a thing.
We've talked about some of the risks. Let's talk about, Greg, some of the benefits of these projects. Obviously, money is a big one, but what are some of the other benefits that the growers could be looking at in these projects?
Yeah, well, there is some, like, the money is a key one because the returns on the wind farm are far greater than what you're likely to generate off that land, either farming or having it leased out over the period. So if, on a genuine cash return, they've made really good financial sense. The other thing about them is in some cases they help with the installation of infrastructure like roads and stuff through the farm, because they need to be able to access wind turbines for servicing and ongoing maintenance and installation. So if it's done in a really collaborative manner, the farm can wind up with better infrastructure for transporting machinery or moving livestock than it had originally. And the other part would be always a curly one in farming, succession planning. Because these generate income not directly tied to farming, there's potential for these assets and the income stream could be put aside for off-farm siblings or whatever, get whatever significant return without having to be directly involved in the farming itself. So there's some real benefits to having a source not directly related to farming in your ability to farm and having an income that in reality will be the profit and the capital growth of land if it's a 5% over a period of time. So these make very good financial sense in a lot of cases.
Those finances are definitely the main thing that growers and farmers are always going to be considering when taking on one of these projects. And Greg, I understand that Farm & Co has a profit series or a benchmark and benchmarking data around the lease agreement or the potential payments from leases compared to the potential income from a renewable energy project, and I guess how that compares to the potential lost income from displaced farmland use. Can you talk me through that data and give us the numbers on where it stands?
Yeah, so if you think about farmland, so normally we get 5% growth on average, and it's been a lot higher in the last few years. And so a rental return might be somewhere around $150 a hectare in the medium rainfall zone and through to nearly $300 a hectare in the high rainfall zone. But when you times that out over 20 years, that's nowhere near the return per hectare that you're going to get from a wind farm. And in fact, the return for the wind farm is in the magnitudes of hundreds better than what we can earn by leasing the farm out to other people. And even if you say that in theory, if we're farming, we should be more profitable than if we've leased it out, and you doubled that number in all those cases, the profitability of the wind farms is still far more, or the cash flow is far more significant, because it's over a period of 20 years, it's anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million for wind farms. And it's probably, including the capital growth, it's probably somewhere only around 30 to 40 grand out of farming per hectare. So even if it's a few hectares, you're looking at between $150,000, $200,000 worth of income versus somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. Really difficult to not go ahead. The risk, I suppose, is what happens at the end of that period if you're left with a concrete slab in the ground, but in reality, you could run it out another 20 or 30 years with not cropping it and still be ahead, or farming it. So it's not the end of the world. And I just think that the end of life stuff needs to be thought about when people are looking at these, because farming's generally a long-term business. But that being said, we've seen corporate America in Esperance early on and they're no longer there. We've seen English corporates out east of Delhi and south of Katanning, and they're no longer there. So corporates will come and go. I suspect wind farms over time will come and go depending on what's happening. and we have to just buy up that return. And at the moment, those returns look really good compared to farming the land. If farmland goes up by the 15, 20% per annum that it has done the last few years for the next decade, well, then it make it a bit more challenging, but I still think it'll look okay.
Fraser, to finish up, can you talk to me about how farmers can go about assessing the values versus the risks for their own operation and how to start that process?
Yeah, certainly. So I think getting as much information as early on as possible is certainly really important. Understanding, and this goes back to what we said earlier and what Greg was saying as well, but understanding what the impact will have on the land and how collaborative they can be with the developer and the whole way through to the construction phase to make sure that what's going to be built works as best as practical with their operations and how they currently use the land. It's definitely worth noting that, I mean, particularly with wind, the amount of land that's required is very small, typically compared to the broadacre farming operations that are going on in the areas. So how then that can be, I suppose, that small amount of land can be best allocated to the renewable project. And as simple as trying to align access tracks with tree lines or fence lines and those sorts of things to really limit the impact on the farming operations that are going to be going on side by side with the renewable energy project over the next 25, 30 plus years. As far as the more, commercial side of things, obviously, yeah, in engaging with their existing consultants, I suppose, the likes of Farm and COVID or the accountants, lawyers and those sorts of things, and making sure that they've got a really good understanding of the process, what it's going to look like financially, what the timeframes are going to look like. A lot of these projects do take many years to get from that sort of inception stage through to construction and operations. They also need to understand that not every project will get to those stages. There will be projects that won't make it the whole way through. And so they need to make sure that the agreements in the meantime still make sense for them. Those early exclusivities and those option agreements still make financial sense at the early stages, because you don't want to go the whole way through the process and not have the project proceed and not have at least covered your costs and been remunerated for those years' worth of engagement, I suppose.
Greg, any final messages from you before we finish up?
Yeah, and just to follow up on Fraser's comment there, that is very true. And talking to various growers when we're surveying for this project, my feeling is those who've had experiences with mining companies and access and pegging and drilling had a far more pragmatic and realistic view around the right for access and those sort of things. And I also like that so far all the proponents I've seen, though I'm not keen on the exclusivity, I know why they're there, the willingness to state what they're willing to pay to do the early survey work for the wind and that and the suitability of the project has been quite good. They've been very transparent around that generally, and I think that's a good sign. I expect that to become more transparent as more of these have gone on.
Fraser, Greg, thank you both so much for joining me and sharing your knowledge from this project with everyone. I really appreciate both of your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Farmanco's limited series on integrating renewable energy into agriculture. This project is supported by the Southwest WA Drought Resilience Adoption and Innovation Hub through funding from the Australian Government's Future Drought Fund.